We look at the moon and wonder what might be up there. We also wonder why we never went back. We were way ahead of the rest of the world, and our lunar missions accomplished amazing things in a short amount of time, and then we just kind of quit. Ken Johnson is a former NASA Photo Control Department manager. He worked for the space agency's Lunar Receiving Lab during the Apollo missions. He says he was fired for coming out saying that NASA knows about ancient alien artifacts discovered on the surface of the moon. And he says the agency has ordered a cover-up and forced him to participate in it. Can he prove it? We'll jump right into that right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Ken Johnson, want to welcome you back to the program. It's been a while, right? You were on here some years ago.
Yes, it was, George. Sure have. It's been
Well,
quite
real
some
a
time.
pleasure to talk to you, and Merry Christmas to you and your family. Thanks for sharing your time with us tonight.
Well, thank you very much. I'm going to enjoy being on with you.
We get a lot of folks who come out of the woodwork in the UFO field and the alien artifact field, and they claim to be whistleblowers, and then you look into their background and it doesn't match up, that they can't really prove they are who they say they are. In your case, though, you can prove it. You were really there. You had this position with NASA, and in checking about other parts of your background, I guess you were more than just, you're not just a pencil pusher or an office manager. You were a test pilot, right, for a while?
That's correct. Actually, when I got out of the Marine Corps in 1966 active duty, I went to work at the Johnson Space Center. It was a manned spacecraft center at that time, and I was picked up by the Grumman Aerospace Corporation at the time as one of the five test pilots. They call us astronaut consultant pilots. I guess we were the beginning of the civilian astronaut corps, if you want to call us that. And our job was to be in the spacecraft and do all the testing. And anytime one of the regular astronauts came in, one of us had to be there to answer any questions about how to fly the lunar module and make everything work.
Man, that's an exciting time to have been there, involved in the program back then. And you look at what the space program was and what it is now, it's so disappointing.
I look back sometimes and I wonder, did I really do all that stuff? And then I go back and look at some of the archives and records that I've got. I said, you bet. I was there, and I turned 70 next year, and that's kind of the thing that catches my attention. That's going to be a landmark. If people that hit 70 and they're as good a condition and health as I am, you would expect to be around at least another 100 years.
All right, tell me about this job, the photo department for NASA. What was your job, and what did you see? What kind of stuff came across your desk?
Okay, well, at the Johnson Space Center, you actually have the Photographic Technology Laboratory, and that's where they processed all of the film. And the director of that was John Holland, and he was the lab director, and John Brinkman was his assistant. They, in turn, sent all of the data, all of the photographs, the reels of film, the 70-millimeter Hasselblad shots. All of that data then was sent to me, and actually I maintained five complete sets of all the data over at the Lunar Receiving Laboratory. So when the astronauts got back the first couple of missions where they were quarantined, I had all of their photographic data before they got out of the quarantine in the Lunar Receiving Laboratory, and they got a chance to pore over some of the pictures and look at the moon rocks that they had brought back and do comparison for and give their first impressions of what it looks like back on Earth and what they thought they had picked up. So my job was to maintain the archives, to work with all of the scientists that were the geologists that were doing the geology of the lunar samples, helped them produce the lunar sample information catalog. It was my job to edit all of it. If you've ever worked with PhD scientists, it's kind of like working with a doctor and trying to read their handwriting. So we had to take their notes and put them into a coherent book published and sent around the world to all the other participating geologists and scientists. And with that, I would have to send them pictures from orbit, where the location was, right down to the picture of the rock on the lunar surface, its orientation with north, south, east, west on the moon, and then photographs as their sample had been thin-sectioned and sliced off of one of the moon rocks, and be sure that they got as much information as they could so they could then do their own personal analysis.
Am I exaggerating to say that pretty much everything came across your desk, everything of a photographic nature?
I thought so. There are times when I've questioned whether I got to see everything. But by and large, I think at the time, almost everything was coming across my desk.
Was there also, I seem to remember reading something online about you that you were, there was some sort of a program involving a telescope, a space telescope, kind of a precursor to Hubble back then?
Absolutely. Once actually, let's see. Go back to the beginning. When we were testing the spacecraft in the vacuum chambers there at CSEL, that's the Space Environmental Simulation Laboratory, where they had civilian astronauts and the astronauts testing it in a vacuum, we could actually pump down the vacuum chambers to 10 to the minus 12 pore, which is like one molecule of air for every cubic yard. It's as close to a hard vacuum as you can get. Once we got that finished up, tested LTA-8, which is at the Smithsonian Institute right now, that spacecraft is, then we wound up, after Apollo 11, they laid a bunch of us off. I had gone to work right after the completion of LTA-8's testing over with a man by the name of John Pierce over at the astronaut office, and we were working on telescope mount, the lunar module telescope mount. What this was is using the ascent stage, where you could use the controls and the flight controls for roll, pitch, yaw, and translation, but mount a large telescope on the bottom. Instead of having the descent stage that was used to land on the lunar surface, we would have a very large telescope on there, and it would be, they would back away from the space lab, which we had back then, and be able to orient any location and take pictures of distant stars and constellations. Well, while I was in New York visiting the in-laws during the Apollo landing and watching it on TV, when I got back to Houston and out at NASA, John Pierce called me and he says, you know, I'm sorry, but NASA got the budget cut and they've canceled the Apollo telescope mount and you've been laid off. So the Grumman was really good to me. They allowed me at least two weeks pay and 2 weeks would just come in, say hello, and then go out look for a job. And that's when I was picked up over at the Lunar Receiving Laboratory, and I actually caught the Apollo 11 astronauts in quarantine without skipping a beat and just continued on doing what we do.
I don't know if I'm just completely off base here. I'm just looking at possible conspiracy theories. The idea of this powerful telescope, was it only going to be looking at deep space stuff, or could it have been trained on the moon as well?
Well, I'm sure we would have been able to take pictures of the moon. When Hubble first went up, I know Richard Hoagland and all, we contacted NASA and tried to get them to take the Hubble and take pictures of the moon. And the story we got back is they couldn't do that. The moon was too bright. It would damage the receptors and the telescope, et cetera, et cetera. And a few years later, we started getting leaked photographs that they were using Hubble to photograph features on the lunar surface. In fact, I think on the internet right now, there's some very interesting pictures that were taken by Hubble of some of the shards, some of the towers. And that telescope is able to get in real close and get some very good very good data that could back up some of the stuff that we had seen in the original Apollo pictures that we brought back. That's kind of an interesting point, because nowadays you're getting digital type pictures back from the spacecraft. They send them back by telemetry, and then they're put together, and you can wind up with some pixelations and some false images and things. What we had at Apollo was considered analog. These were the actual negatives, the actual film strips and everything that were brought back on each mission. And one of the best analysts around that I know that has followed all the way through the Apollo, and that's Steve Troy. Steve Troy is he's a master's degree in art and science, and he only deals with the analog stuff. And he wrote a lot of reports on the Lunar Anomalies webpage. It was up for quite some time. And if you want to talk to someone who can identify artificial or features on the lunar surface that are now being photographed by Hubble, then Steve Troy is the guy you need to talk to.
Tell me this, your mindset at the time, were you a UFO guy? Were you interested in alien artifacts or ETs or any of that sort? Was it the kind of thing that you could openly discuss with your colleagues within NASA back then, before you started looking at these photos?
Well, the whole space program was to accomplish what Kennedy had told us to do, and that is to get to the moon, land safely, and return within the decade. And we were literally driven 24/7s just at light speed to try to make that happen. And if those of us that may have had a few ideas, I really wasn't a real big fan of UFOs or looking into it. A little later, I did get into it very, very heavily. And then it brought up some things that I'll touch on a little later if you want to, of what happened to me in my youth, which makes me think that perhaps there is more to what is going on in my life than what I was prepared to.
Well, let's do that now before we jump into talking about the photos. Let's talk about that now. What happened?
Okay, well, back in 1948, I lived in a little country town, by the way, you know, to a little boy who grew up in a little town of 560 people, wind up going to a military academy, becoming a pilot, winding up at NASA and those things is kind of a far-fetched dream, but that's kind of the thumbnail of my life. Well, we had a huge thunderstorm going on, and the next morning our neighbor, which was about three-quarters of a mile away, came by and said that he thought that we had a huge lightning strike just out in his field, which was across the dirt road from where our little house was. And so I got on my rubber boots and ran out there, and my other two brothers were following me, and I got out there first. And there was a ring. And even though I was only about 7 years old, I remember the ring looked like it was about 50, I'd say about 50 feet across. And it really looked like it was a burned spot, although the neighbor said he thought that it had burned it, because and I'll talk a little bit more on that. Anyway, at this circle, there was this big, giant whooping crane. That's what it looked like to me. As I'm standing there looking at it on the other side of the this burned area, it looked at me, and it turned its head the other way, and then very slowly started to run across the open circle there, and then got airborne, and then disappeared. And that was kind of I told my brothers that, you know, the bird flew away. That was kind of the beginning of it. And then later on, in, I would say, 1952, we had moved into the little town of Hart, and I chalked it off as a rather strange dream, is that I dreamed that there was this spacecraft had landed in this probably about 100-acre field back behind our house there in the town, because it hadn't developed much. And this craft landed. There was a kind of a door came up, and there was kind of a shimmering light around the craft, that, what I'd call it, kind of like a shower curtain or shimmering. And there were a lot of people showed up, and they were looking at it, and everyone seemed to be afraid of it. And my comment was, oh, I'll go see. And I just walked over, and it's kind of like you take an umbrella and you stick it into a rain shower, and the water pours around the side off the umbrella. It opened up and allowed me to walk in. Now, mind you, this may have been a dream or whatever, but the story went on, and I kept every other night or every night or so, I would have the same dream, and I had a little more data was given to me. And then in the dreams, it went over for years. I was supposedly taken on board, taken some place, and then communicated with. They were training me, and ultimately they said they wanted me to become an ambassador and negotiate between their race and our race. Well, as a strange thing might turn out, and my later on in my life, after all the NASA stuff, and I was picked up by the NASA and the Jet Propulsion Laboratory to become, what would you believe it, Solar System Ambassador.
That's the actual title?
That's the actual title that Jet Propulsion Laboratory and NASA uses for those of us that are volunteers. Now, I noticed in YouTube that Ms. Kay Ferrari had said that as I was an employee, and I said incorrectly about my employer. Well, if they were my employer, they should have been paying me, and I would have had quite a few rights. And in fact, when Ms. Ferrari called me and said that the book Dark Mission had come out, and by the way, I think my name's mentioned about 230 some odd times in that book from Mr. Hogan and Mike Barra. But we were discussing the story that I told him about the artifacts and what we had seen on the moon, on the pictures that I was able to look at. She said, oh yeah, we have people with the Jet Propulsion Laboratory that they have their own personal opinions about this and about that, about UFOs, et cetera, et cetera. But yet they were targeting me, talking about what we actually saw and the pictures. And she was saying, well, and the reason this came out, and I'll tell this because anyone else that has ever come out and opened up to the public, you have to be careful about what you say, because there are the hitmen that come out from the government that try to discredit you and any credentials that you have. Well, Mr. James Olberg, who, by the way, was a very good friend of mine back when I was at NASA there in the astronaut building, he and I used to spend hours sitting talking about theories. In fact, he shared this with me, that his master's thesis was on mass media indoctrination. And that was, you know, like he was saying, the first movies came out, The Blob, and everybody was terrified, and on down to where we had Star Trek and going where no man has gone before, and to the point where if a spacecraft landed in the White House lawn and this big fuzzy blue character came out, a little kid would say, look, Bob, there's the Cookie Monster. He's my friend. James, though, had become, he was one of the most knowledgeable, and probably still is, persons. He trans- translated Russian and spoke Russian. He was brought on NASA to NASA from the Air Force to be a liaison and to provide information to NASA about what Russian launches and what missions were coming. In fact, he would tell us when the next launch was going to be, what the names of the Russian pilots would be, and what inclination orbit they were going to have before it was ever before they ever launched and came out. So he was a very sharp, very knowledgeable man. Anyway, as the hitman, as soon as the book came out, I guess probably the next day or so, he contacted Ms. Ferrari and had told them that, you know, my credentials weren't this, I wasn't there, etc., and that so it was going to be embarrassing if they kept me on as a solar system ambassador. So Ms. Ferrari was pushing to try to get me to resign, and I said, you allow other people within your organization to have their own opinions and talk the way they want to, and their employees being paid, I'm a volunteer not being paid, yet you want me to resign. I wasn't going to do that, so they summarily dismissed me. And that worked out pretty good because the following week I went with Mr. Hogan and them to Washington, D.C. and spoke before the National Press Council and laid all the data and information out. And it was Mr. Hogan's plan to get me out into the public so that people knew who I was. He said that it's harder for them to go and bump you off, get rid of you, if your name and face is out there in the public and people know who you are. So, you know, trust me, I'm not tempting them saying find a way to get rid of me. But the point is if they did, then there would be questions raised about what happened to Ken Johnston.
Well, I know that listeners of this program and UFO researchers whom I know would recognize the name of Jim Oberg because whenever anything pops up about NASA or what it might know, suddenly he pops out and is the great defender and the disqualifier of people and the designated attacker sort of a thing. So you guys were buddies. You talked about all kinds of things back in the day. And then when the time comes that you come forward with saying what you've seen, suddenly he becomes your enemy.
Right. And that went on for probably a couple of years where he'd come out and say, well, he wasn't here or wasn't there. And then I would, through Mike Barron, them, I would issue them certificates and documentation proving exactly where I was and what was said. And they would go out and it would shoot him down. This went back and forth until apparently, as I've been told, he was told to back off and back down because there was getting too much publicity out there about what really has gone on. And every time he attacked me, since I must have been a pack rat, or at least I was interested in keeping data for history purposes. At any rate, I had, and I do have, still have all of the information material. So I haven't heard from Froberg in probably a couple of years now, and let's hope that he's learned his lesson and doesn't come out attacking the truth.
Oh, I doubt that lesson's been learned. Tell me this, after he starts attacking you and your qualifications, did you reach out to him, call him up and say, hey, what the heck is this about?
I tried. I tried that. In fact, the Survivor program, they were going to do a Survivor program with 15 Americans and send them over to Russia, Star City, and would go undergo training there. And one of the producers of the Survivor program, one of the trainers and a corporate person, they would be once a week would pick someone to be bumped off, dropped out of the program. And in the end, there would be three left standing, just like they do on Survivor, and they would announce which one was the winner, and they would immediately go with two cosmonauts out to the launch pad, go inside the spacecraft, be launched, and go up and spin. This was the Mir, Russian space station at the time. It was been a week on board the Mir station. Mr. Oberg, I explained it, told him about the program, and he got in touch with him. He was being, he probably won't like the fact that I'm telling the truth. He was going to help in the selection process, and he had guaranteed me that I would be one of the 15, but it would be up to me to be one of the final survivors in that. Well, I guess that all changed after the book Dark Mission came out, because I haven't heard from him since.
Ken Johnson, a former NASA official, we're going to jump into the question of the photos that you saw, the very first one that sort of raised your eyebrow and what it showed and what you think it means. We're going to take a break now. Doors taking us into the break here on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Ken Johnson, former NASA official, who discovered some amazing images in photos taken on the moon. When we come back, we're jumping right into it, what he saw and what he thinks it means here on Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us. Thanks for being with us, everyone. Merry Christmas to you. Ken Johnson is my guest. He was with NASA as a photo manager, saw a lot of strange and interesting images come across his desk. I'll tell you, Ken, just in all honesty, I've heard these stories for a lot of years. I've seen the images, some of them from the moon, some of them from Mars. And people will say, gosh, there's a photo of a skyscraper. And I look at it and I think, yeah, I guess it could be a skyscraper, but it looks just kind of a fuzzy blob to me. In general, how would you characterize the quality of the images that we're about to talk about in terms of showing what you think they show?
Well, I think the advantage that we have with the Apollo pictures is that we actually had the live negatives. And of course, we didn't have the technology that we do then that we do now for the digital type pictures. And I say that because some of the professional photographers that I've talked to talk about that there's so much data captured on the negative that the naked eye just can't quite do it. And different processings can bring out different layers of data and information. So and this, again, it depends upon which level copy that you get. Because right now, if you were to contact NASA and you had asked for Apollo 14 picture 10001 or whatever, you would probably get something around the 8th, 9th, or 15th different generation. And to give an example, if you take a Xerox copy of something and you make a copy of that copy and then a copy of that copy, and each time you do it, it degrades somewhat. Well, the pictures that I kept, and I might as well go into a little story about how I wound up keeping those.
Sure.
There, at the end of Apollo, right at the end of Apollo 15, before the 16, 17, there was a directive came down through NASA headquarters, and I asked where it came from. It said it came from high up, and it was passed down through Brian Irv, who was the director of the Lunar Receiver Laboratory, through Ms. Dorothy Palin. She was in charge of the NASA side of looking over my work at the Data and Photo Control Department, on down to my immediate, this was the Brown & Root Northrop Corporation. BRN was a conglomerate between Northrop.
They're Halliburton now, right?
Yeah, Halliburton, I think so. And they, Bud LaScala would have been my manager within the BRN group. Anyway, he came into me and says, you've been ordered to destroy all of the prints and negatives and everything you have, except for one copy. As I mentioned earlier, I was maintaining it. I had like 12 or four filing cabinets and organized where I kept all of the different pictures. So whenever one of the principal investigator scientists were to come into NASA and want a picture of something, I could go directly to pull out a copy, and then I'd get it replaced. And I maintained five sets. Well, my first reaction was, well, these things are valuable. Any college would love to have a set of these, and why don't we send them out to them? And he says, you were told to destroy everything except for one. I don't care what you do, just get rid of them. So being a good little soldier, I went out and I tossed three sets of them in the Dempsey dumpster. And interesting enough, some data was recently found in a Dempsey dumpster here just about a year ago.
Well, let me ask you this before you move on from that. Is that, if viewing it from a conspiratorial sort of viewpoint, is that really weird, or is that just the government being wasteful as it always is?
Well, I'm not quite one to ask that, I guess. It was strange. It was weird, and my reaction was, well, okay, if I can get rid of them any way I want to. I kept one set, put it in a duffel bag, and that night I took them home with me, and I kept them. So let's see, that would have been Apollo 15. So we were talking about 1971, I think, something like that. And it wasn't until 1995 1977, I went and took the same pictures to my alma mater, the Oklahoma City University, and I donated a large portion of those to their science lab. And since then, I've gone back, and someone has confiscated those, and they disappeared. But that would have been nice to have had all those. Fortunately, I had over 1,000 some other pictures that I kept in my own personal files, whatever, I wound up leaving the space program.
Well, could somebody say this? Well, you were stealing those things.
Well, I suppose someone could make a case for that, but then I could also look at the standpoint, we paid for that with our tax dollars, so, I paid for them. How's that?
Well, I'm not challenging in that regard. I'm just wondering how, if your critics, and I know there are a bunch of them from inside NASA who look at you suspiciously, well, that guy must have stolen these things. He never should have done it. It was against orders.
It probably, and the fact that I didn't dispose of them would have been considered not following all the orders exactly the way they've laid out. I just interpreted it the way I saw fit.
Let's go back to that moment. You got all these images coming across. Do you remember the first one that jumps out at you that you go, whoa, what the heck is that?
Well, I guess the first one really would have been a picture that came from the Russian Zond lunar orbiter, and it was a picture that snapped of the lunar, the lib, right on the surface of the moon, and right on the lip there's this dome that looks fractured and cracked inside it. Several of us have looked at that and thought, now that is something strange. Okay, whenever time that any one of us would see or hear something going on that was strange, you know, we'd say, hey, I want to get back and check that, look into it. But we were so pushed to get to the next mission and the next mission, next mission. And then they laid us all off. When Grumman had the layoff, they laid off some 36,000 employees after the Apollo 11 landing, because they said, we're no longer doing research and development, we're doing routine flights to the moon. So it's kind of tough whenever you're looking at the situation where you want to go back and look at things, you want to check things out, but then all of a sudden you're kicked out and you don't have the resources to be able to go back and try to check those out. I've talked to numerous people that has happened to, and they had the same problem. One of the things I can point out is, shortly after the Apollo program shut down, branch of the government, and I don't know which branch it was, actually came out to those of us that had worked on the missions and confiscated our mission operation handbooks, the diagrams, the schematics, things like that, so that whenever it came around, and I think when George Bush said, we're going to return to the moon, NASA said, oh my God, we don't know how to go there. We don't know how they did it. And they actually came out and interviewed, not me personally, but some of the others were interviewed and and they'd go to museums and they'd take their calipers and their cameras and photograph and measure all the various components and trying to figure just exactly how we were able to put together a spacecraft, the command module, lunar module, and Saturn V. And interesting point, we had three more lunar module spacecrafts that were already in the assembly line, partially completed. Same thing with Saturn V's and the command modules. And then Apollo 17 was shut down and said, that's the end of the missions. We're not going to the moon anymore.
Well, you know what? You don't have to be a conspiracy theorist to see an explanation for that. It's the incompetence and the wastefulness of NASA. I mean, we've seen it again and again in so many ways. But maybe there's more to this than that.
Well, I was also a part of the Speakers Bureau there at NASA. And in that capacity, when some, like the Rotary Clubs or various organizations would like to have someone come out and talk to them about what we're doing in space, well, we would go out and do that. The biggest mistake that NASA made, and I just noticed the reason they're still doing it, when we would have a mission, they would say, oh, that cost us so many hundred millions of dollars. And the average person has no concept of anything that costs more than their house or their car. It's just total waste. But when you really look at spinoffs, and that's one of the things we'd address when we go out to speak to you and talk about, the spinoffs that came from the space program that so far outweighed the cost and far better than technology has advanced through warfare. We were able to advance technology through a peaceful means of going to the moon.
Let's go back to this first image that you saw of this dome-like structure that you thought, wow, that looks really interesting. Did you say to your colleagues, what the heck is that? Help me understand this.
Well, absolutely. And, of course, they were at a loss as well. And that was the first thing that I had seen. Now, I did see some of the other pictures that were taken from orbit on the various missions that looked like, you know, something that wasn't what we would consider. But then again, the moon was considered a different planet, and where things that we might think look perfectly normal on Earth wasn't there, and vice versa. One of the things that I saw was, and I've questioned it many times, it was in, and I can't think of the name of the mission, I think it was Apollo 16. We're down a mountainside, running down into a valley. There's a whole series of tracks. It looks like they were made by the type of treads that a tank would make. And people says, oh, no, that was a boulder that came loose on the mountain and rolled down. Interesting enough, it rolled down so far, one chunk of it broke off and rolled off to the side and to another direction, and this one turned. So, you know, you can't necessarily accept the answers that those in charge are going to throw out to you. The same with the video on Apollo 14, which
we'll talk about that. What video? What did it show?
Okay. All right. In my position at the Data and Photo Control Department at the Lunar Receiving Laboratory, excuse me just a moment here. Dr. Thornton Page, who was the director of the Lunar and Planetary Science Department at NASA, Johnson Space Center, he contacted me and asked me to go to the XT photo lab where they processed them and pull out a specific 16-millimeter reel. Now, what most people don't realize is that while the crew were in the lunar module down on the lunar surface, we had the astronauts on board going around and around the moon taking pictures. Now, on Apollo 14, you know, we had Alan Shepard, Stuart Roosa, and Ed Mitchell. Ed Mitchell kept on board the spacecraft. He had experiments to run, too, and part of it was having in the service module to activate the camera, 16-millimeter. I'd call it a gun sequence camera, and I'll explain that in a minute, taking strips of the terrain of the moon as it passed over. And there, he asked me to check out this film and then give a showing for him, and there were seven other astronomers and scientists that were in the room. And the film is, I start the film up going, I'm using a gun sequence projector, which allows me to stop frame by frame or go multiple frames at a time. I can stop, freeze, zoom in, zoom out. So as we're tracking across the backside of the moon, and at the time this was about to consider a half moon, so the half of the front side was bathed in sunlight and half the backside was. So there was a shadow cast in the bottom of a crater. And as we approached it, in the dark area, there were a cluster of like five domes that were lit from the inside and a little plume that looked like steam or something streaking up above it. He had me stop the camera, freeze, zoom in, back up, go forward several times, and then he turns to his colleagues and says, well, boys, what do you think of that? And they all chuckled and laughed like it was an inside joke. They knew what it was. So he asked me then to complete the reel, and then I did that and checked the film back into the Photographic Technology Laboratory. And as I'm going in, now this is something we put in here at this point, as I was going in into the secret, well, you're required to have a secret clearance to get inside the inner part of the lab. And as I go inside, past the security clearance, there's a light table roughly 4 feet or 3 feet by 3 feet, whatever, it's about that size. And the light table, people don't know, it's an opaque glass top with light projection from the bottom, so that when you put a negative or something on it, you'd be able to light it up so you could see well. There was two guys and a lady there that were painting out stuff on these negatives. And I asked them what they were doing, and one of the guys quipped. He says, hey, we're professional strippers. And I said, the lady, I think, was offended, and she said, no, what we're doing is we were told to paint out along the edge of the horizon on the moon because we don't want the stars to confuse people that are looking at it. And that kind of flashed back to that Zond photograph, which was electronically transmitted from the Russian spacecraft back that showed a dome on the side.
Well, so you personally saw a team, NASA employees, who were doctoring the film and photos?
Absolutely did. And some of the doctoring can go all the way back. It's easy to doctor. It's going all the way back to the Gemini when Ed White did his first spacewalk. The atmosphere inside the Gemini spacecraft was so dry that he had gotten a nosebleed. And he had used his space glove and wiped his nose, and he had wiped it on the fabric on the inside of the hatch. And they didn't pay any attention to that at first, and they produced lithographic photographs of that particular hatch being opened and Ed White going outside in the first spacewalk we ever did. And then they found out, oh, my gosh, we can't let people think that our astronauts are not perfect and that they get nosebleeds and they're normal. So they went back and they airbrushed that out. So that's a real easy way to prove that, yes, they do. Airbrush things out. Now, since then, I've listened and talked to a few people. I've been trying my best to remember the names of people that were there. They introduced themselves. And there's one young lady name that strikes out. I've listened to her talk several times. And she talks as though she says that it was someone else, a friend that she knew that did there. And this is the story the person told them. And the story, the information, the data she had was so thorough and so complete that I'm almost positive that she's talking about herself, but trying not to get thrown in. Her name is Donna Herrera, and that was back in 1971.
Back to the Apollo 14, yep. This film, you mentioned Dr. Edgar Mitchell. Now, that's somebody I know pretty well. He's a friend of mine, and I have had very candid conversations with him about what he may or may not have seen up there. He is very open to the UFO question, as you know, and our listeners know. He speaks openly about it. He thinks there is an alien sort of a presence, that there has been an active cover-up. But he says that he never saw anything, that the astronauts didn't see anything on the moon. How do you reconcile those two,
well,
those two positions?
Since then, and some of the research I've been involved in, comments have been made that the type of reflective covering over the spacesuit helmets actually filtered out the spectrum of light that some of these images would have been able to see if they were up fairly close to a mirror at a reasonable distance, that they probably wouldn't see it. And then again, you have to understand, they're out there, their pulse rates are running, 120, 160 beats a minute, and their adrenaline's pumping, and they're trying to get everything done as quick as they can on the lunar surface and get back in without puncturing their suit and dying on the lunar surface. So, you're going to do your job and not take too much time sightseeing. So I think it's feasible that almost all majority of them weren't aware of things that they were seeing, again, because it's an alien world, and you might be looking at something and not even recognize what you're looking at. That's why, in any investigation, and at least everyone that sees something comes up with a different analysis of what they thought they saw or didn't see.
I understand. I want to jump back into some specific photos and images that I'd like to get your opinion about. But in general, why would you have been allowed to see this in the first place? If this is the biggest secret in the world, if they don't want this out, if there's an active cover-up, why would these images have ever made it to your desk in the first place? Wouldn't somebody have cleaned it up before it got to you?
Well, I had a top secret clearance, and I was cleared for the Photographic Technology Laboratory, and I was privy to the material that came in, such as that film strip. Once we finished looking at it, and I checked it back in, the next day I checked it out to show to the rank and file engineers. And when we were showing the film, we're coming up on this crater, and I'll tell you the name of it in just a minute. And I was ready. I was telling my brother, who was beside me at the time, I said, you won't believe what we found on the moon. And we come up on the crater, and there's a shadow, and there's nothing in the shadow. And I stopped, and I told them I'm having technical difficulties. I checked out the film, and there was no way that what they'd done within 24 hours is they would have had to have cut that splice out, doctored it, re-spliced, and then refilmed the whole strip, because there was no any evidence that I could see with the naked eye that sequence of shots on the 60-millimeter film had been tampered with. So I saw Dr. Pays later that day, and I asked him about what we'd seen on the backside, and he winked at me and says, there was never anything there. That was when I knew that there was more going on the moon than what we were letting out to the public.
And it's the backside, you say, where most of the good stuff is?
Well, no, it's all over the moon, as a matter of fact. Now, in fact, let's see, I was talking with Mr. Steve Troy, and he was telling me some of the craters right in the absolute foresight center of the moon, looking at the Earth. There's a crater there that he says there's all kinds of anomalies. He had written reports and things on some of the structures, the towers, the buttresses, and various things on there. So, no, I think that it's all over. And you can tie that into, if you look at it, what Zachariah Sitchin had done in some of his deciphering of Sumerian text, and where particularly the last book that I know he wrote was The Lost Book of Enki, where Enki and his son went to the moon to see if they could make it would be a worthwhile relay for their process of taking gold and getting it back to Nibiru. And I mean, this is a long story on that, but they were there for months on the lunar surface. So that kind of gives you an idea that they probably left some evidence behind. And if they did go and make observation arcologies there, there's evidence of that in the ancient Sumerian texts.
Ken Johnson, we're going to jump into some specific images. We posted a couple of them on our website for our viewers to take a look at. This blue ship, it's one of them's labeled, and something that looks like a big bunch of wheels. I want to ask you about those. Jimmy Buffett taking us into the break. Boat drinks. Stay with us, everyone, for more of Coast to Coast AM.